This episode is sponsored by our friends at Wild Nutrition, who are offering Desert Island Dishes listeners 50% off a 3-month subscription. If you feel like you're juggling a million different balls and spinning plates at the same time, it can all feel like quite a lot. We all know that good nutrition is key to helping you feel good, keeping you energized and ready for whatever the day throws at you. And this is where good quality food grown supplements can really make a difference too. I love Wild Nutrition. They're raising the bar for women's supplements. They use ingredients as close to their original food form as possible, which means they're better absorbed and retained by your body. And also you know what you're getting. They work hand in hand with farmers and growers to deliver ingredients with integrity. If you're anything like me, you know you should be taking supplements, but it's quite overwhelming knowing where to start. With Wild Nutrition, you get a free consultation with a nutritional therapist, so no matter what your concern, they've got you covered. As a mother of 2 young children, my sleep isn't great, but since starting with the Wild Nutrition Magnesium, I can honestly say my sleep has improved so much. Wild Nutrition is so confident you'll see a difference. They're offering Desert Island Dishes listeners 50% off for 3 months when you visit wildnutrition.com/Desert Island Dishes. That's wildnutrition.com/Desert Island Dishes. If you don't feel the benefits within 30 days, they'll give you your money back. T's and C's apply. Thank you very much to Wild Nutrition.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Margie, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. This week, I met with the woman of the moment, the cookery writer everyone is talking about and who I've been dying to meet and to get on the show. Anna was every bit as wonderful as I thought she would be, and we sat in her lovely garden on a hot summer's day talking all things desert island dishes, and it was dreamy. I also haven't stopped thinking about her pizza oven that she has in her garden, and now I know I need one. Without further ado, here is Anna. My guest today is Anna Jones. Anna is a cook, food writer, and food stylist. She decided to quit her day job after reading an article about following your passion in the newspaper. Within weeks, she was signed up on Jamie Oliver's 15 Apprentice program, and she went on to be part of Jamie's food team, has cooked for royalty and politicians. She has written not one, not 2, but 3 best-selling books and has been hailed the Queen of Greens. Her food has been described as cosmopolitan, strengthening the passion for international cuisine, but with a twist, as all her recipes are exclusively vegetarian. Welcome, Anna.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you have the most amazing reviews of all of your books. Have you read them all?
I don't think I've read all of them. No. I have definitely, I've read quite a few of the ones in the press, I guess.
I mean, they're incredible.
Yeah, I feel really lucky that my books have been received in the way that they have, especially seeing as there's so many cookbooks that exist in the world right now.
There are a lot of cookbooks, but I don't think it's just luck. It's all very well deserved. I mean, the Sunday Times has hailed you the new Nigella.
Oh yeah, that was quite that's quite a funny one.
Yeah. What do you think the current Nigella thinks of that?
Oh, the current Nigella is one of my absolute heroes, and she'll never be matched, will she? She's a one off.
She is
completely
she's
amazing.
One of a kind.
So yeah, no, it's always good. It's, you know, amazing even to be in the same sentence as someone like Nigella.
But yeah.
Yeah. I think the guy who was writing it probably was kind of messing around.
Anna, that is simply not true. But also Nigel Slater is another hero of yours, and he declared you brilliant.
Well, yeah, he is a really, really sweet man. We actually have the same publisher, so we've kind of become sort of friends over the last few years, which is kind of crazy because he has been someone who I have idolized for many, many, many years. And he, yeah, is lovely and has been so encouraging and supportive.
Didn't he give you quite a good definition of what a successful book is?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when my first book came out, I loved the process of writing it. I loved the process of shooting it. But that period of time after it was done and before it came out, before I knew how it was going to be received and who was going to buy it, and I kind of had very low expectations. I just hoped if my mom and some of my aunties and a few people bought it, it would be a real triumph. But I was really, I think I'm quite like affected by what people think of me. And so I sort of said to Nigel, Nigel came up and said, oh, your book is wonderful. It was a few days after it came out. It's such a success. And I sort of said, well, is it really a success? And he said, Anna, if one person cooks a meal from your book and they enjoy it around the table with their family, then your book has been a success. And that just completely flipped for me, actually, what my definition of success around all this cookery book writing was going to be. And I'm really grateful to him.
Yeah, that's such a good way of looking at it. Because it's true, that is such an amazing thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nigel, what a dreamboat.
Hero.
You grew up in California, so I'm looking forward to hearing your first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Oh, yeah. Well, this I don't think is going to be very California.
Okay.
I did spend quite a few years in California and absolutely loved it. And I think it has influenced my cooking a lot. But I think the dishes that we ate growing up were quite British.
Okay.
My dad worked quite hard when we were young, wasn't around that much. I think probably the same as lots of, you know, fathers in that, you know, generation. But he was always around on Saturdays and we'd always play together. We'd go to the garden. He'd, you know, take us out for dinner or whatever. And we'd all hang out together as a family. And on Saturday lunchtime, dad would always make banana sandwiches.
Ooh.
Which, I mean, if you sort of suggest that to anyone else apart from a British person, I think they're going to think you're absolutely bonkers because it's a weird concept.
Yeah. So wait, are we talking bread or toast?
Oh, yeah, bread. So no toast.
Okay, just butter?
Yeah, fluffy white bread, butter, and like mashed banana.
Ooh.
But not too mashed. There's just like, there's basically like a... there's a sweet spot.
Yeah, there's an art to this sandwich.
Yeah, there's an art to this.
Be ridiculous.
In fact, my dad is the best sandwich maker. I mean, self-professed. But he does make a damn good sandwich.
Those are the best titles.
But yeah, he does make a damn good sandwich. But that just reminds me of like my whole family being together, of those very carefree days where we could just, you know, skit around and run in and out of the garden. And I think he made them a lot more during summer. Or I remember that anyway. And it was kind of the day mom didn't worry too much about cooking or anything. And yeah, we just sit around and eat them. And there was just like, there was kind of nothing to do.
Yeah.
Which just felt really, but everything to do at the same time. You know, there was a freedom to those days. And yeah, that's why I love them.
Yeah, that's such a nice memory because it just shows it's not the complicated food and it doesn't have to be anything sort of remarkable that stays in your head and sort of marks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it couldn't be less remarkable.
Yeah, but that's so nice. Sandwich. Yeah.
And the weird thing is like, I don't actually really, and as I'm saying this to you, I've just realized this, I don't actually really like bananas.
Oh.
Like, I don't really like them. Like, I would never like peel a banana and eat it.
Really?
I would, yeah. I'd eat like a banoffee pie or I'd have like banana ice cream, but
yeah,
like a banana on its own, there's something about that I don't dig. And that makes it, obviously, that kind of nostalgic memory is so super strong that I,
in
spite of that kind of like, you know, not an aversion, but the fact that they're not my favorite thing, it still draws me in.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
They're a very good answer there, Anna. It sounds like your mum was a really great cook, but she didn't love to spend hours in the kitchen, did she?
Yeah, no, she... So my mum is, and yeah, it is a really good cook. She cooks way less these days because I think, yeah, she... My mum's quite a feminist, I guess. She, I think, saw kind of cooking as a bit of a kind of infringement on her liberty, I guess. Just that... That not the fact that she had to cook, you know, not cooking, but the fact she had to cook every night and
that it was her role.
Yeah, there was something sort of quite duty bound about it.
Yeah.
I just think made her feel uncomfortable. And so I think she just kind of like rushed through it, as you do now. Like before I used to be like, Mom, why haven't you made a bechamel tonight? Yeah. And now I actually have a kid. I'm literally like, yeah, I totally get it. but yeah, so I think she just kind of... There was never that kind of like long languishing days, stirring jam pans, you know, learning kind of like grandmother's recipes. It was much more, you know, get
practical,
some nourishing, delicious food on the table for dinner. But it was all done in the sort of speediest way possible, which I think is how most of us do actually cook now. So, yeah, I didn't learn stirring the jam pan. I actually learned because my mom... I showed an interest in cooking. She bought me loads of cookbooks, loads of kids' cookbooks, loads of ingredients, and allowed me to cook the dinner when I was really little.
So, amazing.
Amazing for her, yeah. Amazing for me.
Yeah, you see what her plan was there. and you got into cooking really young, didn't you? Sort of age 9 or 10, you discovered the joy of cooking. And you say that you could be found in the kitchen whilst your friends were playing outside. And that just made me think we would definitely have been friends. Yeah. But what was it about the cooking that sort of drew you in so much? Was it the food that you could then eat, which I know was sort of largely my draw, or was it sort of the magic of the process?
I think it was a mixture of everything. I think me and my sister were definitely like greedy children, yeah. You know. We ran around and burnt it all off, but we loved, like, she brought us up to, you know, in a way that's very fashionable now, to kind of like whole grains, very little sugar, you know, lots and lots of kind of like nourishing natural food. But yeah, I think that developed a little bit of a fascination with sugar for us, yeah. As soon as we could get our hands on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were kind of, quite sort of, yeah, sugar hungry. I remember my sister actually used to come home from school and she'd get like, my mom would buy us like little mini chocolate bars because obviously she didn't want us to have a big one. She wouldn't have bought them for us at all unless we pressurized her. And my sister would take like 5 or 6 Mars bars, put them in a cup, put them in the microwave and melt them together and then eat them with a spoon.
Oh my goodness. So, I mean,
we're that talking like next level chocolate stuff, but also incredible invention.
Incredible invention.
Yeah, incredible invention. So yeah, I think the cooking I love the feeling of taking something to the table or even just taking like a little cake around and the kind of encouragement I got from that. And I think my parents actually are amazing at that. I've seen that now as they become grandparents with my son. They are so encouraging.
Are they?
Like, I could literally make my dad like a really rubbish plate of food and he would be like, this is the best thing I've ever eaten.
That's so cute.
Which is so sweet. So I think that element of kind of being able to kind of like show love to people and being able to kind of you know, be kind of like that, have that connection and have, I guess, that kind of that praise and that kind of
it's like validation and
I think that was a huge thing for me. And you know, at school I was like a bright enough kid, but yeah, I just don't think anything really set me on fire at school. Like, I love drawing and I love drama, but I think that, you know, when I went to school, drawing and drama were kind of like on the side. And
yeah.
Then the other things were kind of, you know, the main thing. So I think having that outlet at home was really important. And also I loved the alchemy of it. Like, I think I just couldn't get over how if I mix some flour and eggs and a bit of sugar together, I'd get these cupcakes.
I know, it's amazing.
And then I could put like Smarties on top of them or whatever. You know, it was like, and the fact that I could do that myself, it was really, really, really empowering.
Definitely. That actually brings us very nicely onto the second desert island dish. And that is the first dish that you learned to cook.
Oh, yes. So I think that is... Well, there were two things I made, actually, loads. I think before Mum felt confident with me using the oven and stuff like that on my own, I used to make fruit salads, which is okay. so weird. Yeah. But like, we'd have like a family dinner, and then she'd be like, right, you can make the pudding, give me loads of fruit to chop up. And I'd chop it all up. And then I'd make these really intricate like designs the top out of fruit, which is very hashtag smoothie bowl.
It really is. Yeah, you were ahead of the time.
So yeah, but I used to make like, and she'd buy like star fruits and all these like crazy exotic fruits. And I'd make these like incredible little sort of like, you know, mosaics, I guess, out of fruit.
I thought you were going to say you got into sort of that amazing fruit carving where you sort of...
Oh, yeah, that would be good. that would be good.
But this is also cool.
Yeah, I used to work with a chef who carved a crocodile out of fruit once.
Oh, wow.
Still too far for me, but best of luck to him. So that was one of the things I made. And the other thing I made was the classic thing. It was kind of cupcakes, biscuits, flapjacks. But I think cupcakes were the one. My sister was really, really into baking anything sweet, as we've already established.
Yeah.
But yeah, cupcakes were one of the things that I think I made a lot of. Just because I think I got the hang of the recipe. And then I kind of knew it by heart. And I knew I could go home and make them really quickly.
Yeah. Also back then... they were probably fairy cakes.
Fairy cakes, fairy cakes. Yeah, not cupcakes. No. Fairy cakes.
And did cupcakes even exist?
Well, I don't
know. Are they like a recent invention?
Probably somewhere in America they existed.
Probably, yeah, that's true.
No, they'd be fluffy white little, you know, sponge cakes, and then they'd just have, you know, that thin icing.
Yeah. Ugh.
And I think we probably had loads of different food colorings, which were definitely not natural in any way.
Not natural, but necessary.
Chocolate, and then we just topped them with loads of different things. So, yeah. But there's just something so fun about a fairy cake, isn't there?
So fun. Yeah. Also, slightly better than a cupcake because in one.
Yeah, in one. Yeah, exactly.
You grew up loving cooking, but it wasn't actually something that you ever thought about doing as a career, was it?
Not really, no. I think we touched on it earlier. Like, I definitely felt more engaged in the kind of sort of left brain, like creative side of things. But then my right brain worked quite well as well. So I think I was kind of, yeah, distracted a bit by that.
Yeah.
And at the schools I went to, they definitely valued kind of like academia and, you know, those kind of like knowledge-based skills much more over the kind of visceral, more creative things.
And it's just... an awareness of what the different jobs you can do are, and if people around you aren't doing
exactly.
something in cooking, sort of you just don't naturally think of it.
Well, I didn't. I knew I loved cooking, but I never considered it as a job.
Yeah,
because I was considering all these jobs that you got a degree and then you went onto a training scheme and you did all these things for. And actually, I think if someone had, you know, your story is your story, and I'm really happy I did all the things that I've done. Now I'm quite passionate, especially about chatting to like young women about the different routes there are within the food industry and the food media and all of these things, because, you know, it's not, if you love food, being a chef is not the only route. And that was the only route in my head.
Yeah, know? That's so true.
I didn't realize that there was this whole, like, you know, sort of rainbow of different things you could do within food.
Yeah. And so at the age of 24, you did a sort of culinary about turn, and in a series of events that you yourself describe as a bit of cosmic ordering, you ended up working for Jamie Oliver. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about?
Yeah, that was a pretty wild couple of weeks, actually. I basically was on the way to work reading an article in the paper, which I think you mentioned earlier about your calling, and it said you turn your calling by which part of the paper you read first. For me, it was always the restaurant section. So, and then it was from that moment, it was like a light bulb had gone off in my head, and I was like, oh, okay, maybe this could be the route. Maybe this could be something I could turn into my job. And I kind of went in to the job that I was doing. I was not very passionate about, very nice people.
Yeah.
Apologies. if I was a bit lazy and rubbish, sorry. I Googled cooking courses in London, and up popped Jamie Oliver and the 15 course. And I thought, well, that looks brilliant and fantastic, but I'm never going to get onto that because, as we've established, I've, you know, did a degree. I've kind of like had, you know, a lovely supportive family, and I've had, you know, a really brilliant upbringing. And, you know, the kind of headline on the Jamie Oliver course was that it was for kids from challenged backgrounds, whatever. Yeah. But I thought, you know, what the hell?
I've got nothing to lose.
I'll just put my name in anyway and see what happens. And went for some interviews, went for some more interviews out this weird sort of Outward Bound centre in Wales where we had to like build, you know, shelters out of toothpicks and that kind
as
of
you
thing.
Do.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, about a week later, I had a place on the 15 cooking course. And
oh,
I
was my goodness. Kind
of, yeah. And then I think we started 3 or 4 days later and I was in the kitchen. I had to quit my job and say, I'm just not coming back. Today.
How amazing is that?
Yeah, it was amazing.
It must have felt, yeah, as you say, like that you were on the right course, because how can things just fall into place and happen so quickly if you're doing the wrong thing?
Absolutely. I didn't question it once. I just, no. You know, it was obviously all of the, all
everything
of the
lined up.
Everything lined up and it felt so right.
Yeah. And it happened so quickly. What did your friends and family say? Were they...
Well, loads of my friends were really supportive. I guess Jamie had just had his like first series and he was that kind of real kind of laddie, kind of like driving around on a moped.
Yeah.
And I did kind of think, oh, like how are some of my friends going to perceive this? Because, you know, he kind of split opinion back then a bit. But, you know, I love the guy. And yeah, my family were amazing and supportive. I went from a job that was paying me a decent salary with kind of good, solid prospects, you know, to...
The unknown.
Yeah, the unknown and earning less than really I needed to just eat basic food and support myself. So, yeah, but my parents in their ever encouraging way were super supportive. So, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. The third desert island dish is the best dish you've ever eaten.
Wow, this is a really hard one.
Yeah.
It's a really, really hard one because I feel like I've been lucky enough to eat a lot of really, really delicious food. And yeah, I've eaten in some amazing restaurants. I've eaten at some lovely chef's houses, you know, and I was lucky enough to eat Jamie Oliver's food for many, many years, cooked by the man himself, which, side note, he is so annoying because he basically... Just like you'd make something and think it was the best possible thing you could ever have made. And then he'd just be like, why don't you put that and that on it? And you'd be like, weird idea. You'd go and do it. And you'd be like, oh, tastes 100% better.
That is annoying.
Really annoying. But yeah, I think the best thing I've ever eaten was when I was doing a bit of cooking out in Tuscany. So as part of my sort of cooking training, yeah, I went out and lived in Tuscany, worked in this kitchen with... It was me and then like 10 Italian men. I couldn't speak any Italian. They couldn't speak any English. So it was a real baptism of fire.
Yeah.
Did 6 double shifts a week. And yeah, it was wild, but an incredible education in food. And I was, so on my day off, I used to get a bus from the little kind of monastic sort of town that the restaurant was in down to Siena. And every day off, I'd go on a little food pilgrimage and I'd try and find, you know, a new place to eat. And one day, in the middle of the porcini season, I walked into this restaurant. And also, it was quite weird because the sort of macho culture in Italy, I was a girl, quite a young girl on her own, walking into a posh restaurant, asking for a table for one. It was kind of, the whole thing was a bit awkward.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wanted to experience the food culture there. So I went in, sat down, and I just said, give me what is best. And this plate of porcini came out and they'd cut them. The porcini must have been so big. They were like, I don't know, the size of like bigger than the biggest chip or polenta chip you've ever seen. They were probably 3 or 4 centimeters across and a couple of centimeters deep, these huge fingers of porcini. And they'd been just floured very lightly and then fried very lightly. And they were like, honestly, like eating the most delicious clouds that you have ever experienced. They were kind of perfectly salty with this really kind of subtle but perfect crust on the outside. And then inside, they just kind of like melted.
Oh,
and they were so delicious. And I wish I'd written this restaurant down because I can't remember where it was. And I've been back to Siena once and me and my husband went literally round every street until we were kind of like blue in the face.
In porcini season every year.
Yeah, but I do also think that sometimes those moments are those moments and you just have to, you know, you have to just relish the fact that that happened and realize that it probably won't.
Because even if you went back the following week, there's no guaranteeing it would have the same effect. So
Or the porcini would be right. Or, you know, that just also, that joy of having a day off when you work six doubles in a row, you know.
Nothing better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there's so many different facets that add to the deliciousness of something.
Definitely. Yeah. It's not just about the food.
And even just sitting on my own and being able to appreciate every mouthful in a different way than I would have been if there were 10 people around the table or two people around the table.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. And this is a very difficult question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you could only eat the food of one country forever, which country would it be?
Oh, God, that's really hard. But I think it would be Italy.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say that. I read something where you said you could easily eat pasta every single day. And yeah, I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah, I could eat pasta for every meal.
Yeah, me too. I could probably eat even breakfast.
I've
done that.
I could. But yeah, I think there's just something about the Italians and about their generosity and about the way they respect ingredients and just about the love, like that connection between their hearts and their plates that, you know, happens in a lot of other cultures. But yeah, there for me is the one.
Yeah. So you loved cooking at home and for friends, but it's such a different type of cooking in a restaurant environment, isn't it? Did you enjoy that instantly when you got to Jamie Oliver's?
Yeah, I did. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I love the adrenaline of it. I love the kind of energy of it. I love the camaraderie of it. I absolutely loved it. I think I've definitely got like a, people are quite surprised by it because I think I come across in a different way, but I've definitely got quite an alpha side that I can switch on.
Oh, really?
If I need to.
Like Beyonce, you've got sort of two.
Well, I mean, we've already done a Nigella comparison. Let's go the whole hog.
Come on,
I'm basically Beyonce. Well, I just think that I'm quite like soft and gentle and calm most of the time, but when I need to, I can definitely kick into a different gear, which I think was really, really useful in the kitchen because I think you have to hold your own and it's a really frenetic environment and you have to be quite direct at communication. You have to not be worried if people aren't saying please and thank yous because there isn't
time.
Yeah, quite the time for that. So I really, really, really loved it.
Because it was a proper, the idea was, it's a proper restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
You were apprentices and you were just thrown in the deep end and taught on the job.
Yeah, exactly. So we did a few weeks at like a catering college, but it was literally weeks, like 4 or 5 weeks or something. And then we went into the kitchens and for a while we shadowed another chef. So there'd be two of us on each section. But in a lot of ways, having two people on each section is just a bit more annoying because there's not quite enough room in a kitchen for that. And then slowly, you know, our mentor chefs were kind of pulled away and we took over the kitchen. So it was done in a very brilliant one-on-one protected process. And I don't think there's any other cooking course in the world
where
you would get to shadow another chef. So I always say, it was like sort of cooking on fast forward, really.
Yeah, an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And I think there are a few moments definitely within the kitchen where it got a bit too alpha and there were a few, you know, a few of the guys who were just not behaving in a way that, you know, I was into. But at 15, actually, it was a very protected, nurturing environment. It was when I stepped out of there, I realised how
it can
full-on sometimes kitchens can be.
Yeah, definitely. The fourth desert island dish is one I know you've been dreading a little bit. It's what is your favorite sandwich?
Yeah, this one's really hard, you know. I'm just not sure because I've already had a sandwich. I had a banana sandwich. It's a really, really, really difficult one because I love sandwiches.
Okay,
and we make sandwiches here all the time.
Options.
So the options, I think. So I grew up loving like a club sandwich.
Ooh, yes.
Obviously, I don't eat like bacon or any meat anymore or any fish, but so I grew up kind of loving that idea of a club sandwich.
Do you know what I learned the other day about a club sandwich? Do you know why it's called a club
sandwich?
Chicken lettuce under bacon.
Oh,
I know. Your mind a little bit blown.
I
thought it was just because it was often served in tennis clubs.
Like in a club. Yeah. That's what I thought. I thought it was just because it was a club.
Yeah, me too.
But so I make a sort of take on a club sandwich, which I started making because I made it once. My husband absolutely loved it.
What's in
so
it?
It's kind of like tempeh that I kind of like do with a bit of smoked paprika, a tiny bit of maple syrup, and cut it really, really thin. So it's basically got that crunch and that kind of like umami situation that you like. Lots of mashed avocado with loads of lemon zest, like roasted tomatoes, and then some lettuce for crunch. And I think that is probably my favorite sandwich. So it's a kind of
that
like,
sounds really good.
Like a kind of vegan club situation. Yeah.
And are you putting the extra piece of toast in the middle?
I mean, I don't do that very often, but on special occasions, yeah. Save the extra piece of toast for special occasions.
I like that, a special occasion piece of toast. Yeah. Well, that sounds incredible.
Yeah, so I think that would be my favorite, because I think what people miss in a sandwich sometimes is those layers of texture. I think sometimes it can be just one layer, and that's why you like banh mi, you know, the amazing Vietnamese sandwiches. I love those, you know, because you've got all those different textures going on.
Yeah, just so. Because it's a sandwich doesn't mean you can't build different flavors, different textures.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want a sandwich now.
Great.
Okay, so you're working in Jamie's. You then did some stints abroad working in different restaurants. And then when you came back, you started working for him as a food stylist. You were helping to write recipes and helping make all of his food look delicious and amazing. How did you make the transition from being a restaurant chef to doing that different kind of work?
It happened quite naturally, actually. I think one of the things I really, really enjoyed in the kitchen was one of the first sections you go on in a kitchen is like the colds or the salad section, where you kind of like put out all the cold starters or whatever. And so there's none of the kind of, you know, there's none of the pans and the heat and in and out of the oven and that kind of action. But it's sometimes it's a bit slower pace, which is why they put the you know, less experienced people on there. But it's really nice because you have a bit of extra space to kind of play with stuff. Lots of the ingredients are like, because they're raw, they're salad leaves, they're quite pretty. And I love that section. And that was always my favorite. And so I love, you know, that kind of aesthetic sort of side of it. So it happened quite naturally, actually. I think I was just working upstairs one day and Jamie and his food stylist Ginny was doing a shoot, and I just said, what's all this about? Can I come and help? And then it kind of just happened quite naturally. I think the writing side of things has always been a big thing for me. I've always really enjoyed writing. You know, all the subjects I studied were all big kind of like long essays.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. So I think that and the structure of writing a recipe, I actually really love, because I'm not great at writing. If you want to write, you know, 100,000 words, or, you know, I have so much respect for novelists and fiction writers who write these long form things.
That's interesting that you say that, because I think your recipe books, obviously the recipes are amazing, but it's also the words and the writing around that. Like, thank you. Definitely.
Well, no, I do love it, but I do think that if I had like, if I sat down at my computer with a, you know, 50,000 word manuscript, I think my mind would explode.
And for anyone who doesn't know, I always think food stylist sounds very glamorous, which, you know, in part it probably is, but it's very hard work, isn't
it? It's the most ridiculous job to work for. I mean, before people knew what a food stylist was, when I was doing food styling, I used to say it and people would literally look at me and be like, what is she talking about? Because it just sounds like you're sort of lining up rocket leaves or sort of pampering courgettes or, you know, giving tomatoes a little facial spritz or whatever. But
oh my God, I love the sound of that. That should be a job.
That should be a job. I think in my whole career, which has, you know, been about 15 years now, I have had one job where I had to spritz strawberries.
Oh, really?
And that was it. Every other job, you're basically, you know, it's like being a chef. You go in, you cook all day, but you have the extra added pressure of making the food look incredible. And it's a different way of cooking, and it's a different skill. But I've never made a plate of food that wasn't seasoned and wasn't absolutely like delicious.
So you're not varnishing at the end.
No, and I think that food styling has got this really weird reputation from two or three people, and probably from the 1980s.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
That people used to varnish stuff, and no one does that anymore. It's, you know,
varnishing is out.
Varnishing is out the window, man.
Anna, the fifth desert island dish, what's the dish you eat the most often?
So I think that there's a few things we eat on repeat, basically. And since having my son, who's 2.5 now, the cooking we do at night has definitely become simpler. Okay. but I kind of love simple food. My husband John loves a pasta pomodoro, so we eat that a lot.
Yeah.
Just to really, really, you know, super simple, loads of good olive oil, loads of Parmesan or ricotta salata. So that's a favorite. But I think the one we actually eat and make the most is dal, because I think it's super quick to make. There's a recipe in my first book, actually, which I somehow, you never know what recipes people are going to connect with.
Yeah.
And that has definitely been the most cooked recipe of all the recipes I've ever written. And,
oh, really?
And, you know, you always want your most cooked recipe to be like the one with the most unusual flavor.
Yeah.
Or the one that's the most like visionary or whatever. And quite often it's actually just like the simplest one.
But so, isn't that so nice? Because that means it's the one that is sort of part of people's lives, yeah, in a really, yeah, real
and
way.
And I think that is what, you know, that's what I want kind of my recipes to be. And
yeah,
this one is really part of our life. It's just,
so what's the secret?
It's just a red lentil dal with some coconut milk, some lots of like South Indian spices and some crispy sweet potato on top. And then I make a really, really quick little chutney out of, you could freshly grate coconut if you want. I've done that about once in my whole,
yeah,
life.
Yeah, way more fast than well.
So you just make it out of rehydrated, like desiccated coconut, curry leaves, mustard seeds, and it's kind of, the whole thing takes like 25 minutes, maybe a bit longer if you're not a professional chef. So I'll give you a longer timing just in case anyone's gonna
anyone's, you know, timing. Yeah. Anna, like, it took longer.
It took me 2.5 hours. So yeah, but it's just a lovely, it's how I love to eat. It's layers of flavor and texture, but it's also comforting, filling, nourishing.
Yeah, you know. I'm not surprised.
It's got it all.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that's so popular. That sounds delicious. And so, yeah, you are vegetarian, but you haven't always been. So when you started working as a chef, you weren't. And then when you became vegetarian, that must have felt like quite a big step sort of professionally.
Yeah, it definitely was. I was quite scared, actually, because I knew in my bones it was a move I really had to make for me,
yeah,
personally, for my kind of like well-being, I guess. And also when I stopped eating meat, the idea of eating animals or fish became quite abstract to me. So it was something that I had to do, that my, like, that I was being called and pulled to do, I guess, which sounds a bit hippie, but you get me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was at a time when, like, you know, St. John's was like the restaurant, like nose-tail eating was, yeah, the thing. Everyone was like stuffing trotters and, like, you know, like, I don't know, boiling pig's heads or whatever. And whilst, you know, I still respect each individual's decision to eat what they want to eat, it totally wasn't my bag.
Yeah, so it was brave professionally, because, as you say, you were going against the grain for what was
totally
sort of trendy and fashionable,
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah, it did really feel like that. Like, hardly anyone I knew was vegetarian. Obviously, there were some lifelong vegetarians and,
yeah,
friends of mine, but within the food industry, like, saying I was vegetarian, well, when I said it to chef friends of mine, they were literally like, yeah, good one. Kind of like, how are you going to carry on with your job?
Yeah.
And there was actually that fear. And for a while I was vegetarian, but obviously I still had to cook meat. And if there's a couple of really trusted friends I have who I really trust their palate, and I feel like it's very similar to mine, so I'd get them to try it. But if they weren't around, I would try a spoonful of it, because I didn't feel like it was fair to be serving,
yeah,
food to people without having tried it. But
yeah.
Yeah, I don't,
it's
do
tricky,
that anymore. But it was definitely a professional risk, but yeah.
But one that has paid off, Anna.
And ultimately, yeah,
yeah,
it's been all right.
And that's why your food is so clever, because the dishes don't feel like side dishes. It doesn't feel like anything's missing. They're sort of hearty and wholesome, and they're so clever.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're on to the sixth desert island dish. What is your go-to dinner party dish?
So dinner party, I think it's such a funny term, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's actually quite a cool pairing of words when you think about it. But the connotations around it make you think that you need to make a mousse and a coulis.
Yes, that's
and
true.
And loads of other things that have 80s names.
Yeah.
French, probably, actually not 80s, probably French names that were,
yeah,
popularized in the 80s. But so for me, having people around for dinner is the exact opposite of,
okay,
all of those things.
You're not making mousse?
I love to make a chicken mousse. No.
that would be a surprising answer, Anna. I'm not going to lie.
No. I love just making colourful food everyone can share. So I pretty much always make Mexican food.
Ooh.
So we'll make tacos. Sometimes we make the tortillas here, but amazingly now, there's good corn tortillas you can buy in the UK. So we'll make loads of different things that people can build. The tacos themselves will generally do like a delicious kind of bean situation, black beans or cannellini beans, depending on the weather. And then we'll just use like whatever seasonal veg is around. We'll char it, we'll season it. I'll make a salsa out of, you know, loads of different tomatoes, charred chilies, charred onions, roast garlic. If it's summer, we'll char lots of corn, and then we'll just have big bowls at the middle of the table for everyone to kind of like dive in and help themselves. And yes, I love that kind of food.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. Do you get to throw many dinner parties?
You know what? Not loads and loads. Just more before I had my little boy, but now, yeah, I think we're back into like dinner party mode now. The first couple of years of having a kid, you know, no one sleeps that much.
No. Don't tell me, Anna.
Yeah, and the idea of planning dinner parties, you know, you're planning other things. But yeah, definitely into some more dinner parties now.
I should say we're sitting in your gorgeous garden and you've got a full-on pizza oven.
Yes.
I bet that gets brought out for some big parties.
Yeah, it's actually my husband's birthday in a couple of weeks. So we're
having pizza party.
We're having a pizza party. Oh. Yeah, and it's amazing. You can do all sorts of stuff in it as well.
That is the actual dream, Anna.
Yeah.
The book writing process itself, can you get over the fact that you're creating books that people then buy and then actually cook from? Isn't that amazing?
Not really.
Yeah.
I find it absolutely like mind blowing, actually, that people sit around their own kitchen tables and make food that I have thought up in this little kitchen here. You know, it's like it is
very surreal.
It's really surreal, and it's actually, I'm gonna sound like really, you know, ridiculous here, but it's an incredible honor. I think that the food that you put in your family's mouth and that act of cooking for them and honoring them and loving them in that way is one of the most beautiful things we can do for the people around us. And so for me to have any part in that role, you know, once I've handed the book over, that's someone else's thing. That's their cooking the recipe. It's their thing. It's their love. But just that they might choose my recipe
is amazing.
It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously you're a very modest person. So you've already said when you wrote your first book, you sort of would be happy if family and friends had bought it. But it's safe to say, I don't know how many friends you have, but it's more people have bought the book than you know. And now you've written three best-selling books. I mean, that's just amazing.
Yeah, no, it is really amazing. And I think I have that typically English thing of just being like, oh yes, fantastic. I've always been quite ambitious and quite driven, so I have like a tendency to look forward.
Yeah. But I'm making you look
back. But actually, you know what? A couple of weeks ago, my latest book won an award, the best cookbook at the Guild of Food Writers Awards, which
is amazing.
Is a huge thing, and it actually made me sit and think, hold on a second, this, you know, you reach these milestones in your career that perhaps when you were little you dreamt about. And I think I've been so busy and so focused on what's coming next. It's been quite a lot of times I haven't actually just allowed that to kind of settle and sit and to congratulate myself on that. So I've been trying to be a bit better at that, basically.
Yeah, well, but that's so good that something like that, like an award, sort of allows you to do that.
And I think it is, you know, as I say, that's kind of validation from the industry and the people, but the validation that I get from the amazing people who cook the recipes is a big thing. And I think if I, you know, could look back to that little girl who used to pretend to do cookery shows to like the pot plants, you know, when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Lily has been friends.
Yeah, she would be pretty stoked.
Yeah, of course. I know you're an avid cookbook collector yourself, with a collection to maybe rival even my own. We have a cookbook corner on Desert Island Dishes.
Oh.
Which book are you going to send to our Desert Island Hall of Fame?
I have so many cookbooks, and quite a lot of cookbooks have like a certain lifespan. I guess it's like friends. You have like these really, really old friends who you know you can go to when, you know, things get bad or there's a challenging situation, and they'll be there for you. And then you have other friends, like new friends who might be fun to go out and party with, or, you know, if you've just become a mom, you might go down the playground with them or whatever. But those old friends will never go away. And so I definitely have like my new friend cookbooks who are like, you know, in my kitchen on my shelf for like 6 months.
Ready to party.
But the ones, I mean, this there's three books I'm cooking from loads at the moment. One is Sulfur Acid Heat by Samin Nosrat, who we talked about. And I think like an indispensable book for anyone who wants to like cook from their head rather than from a piece of paper. The Violet Bakery Cookbook is constantly by the side of my cooker because I'm not an instinctive baker. I need a recipe. And I think Claire's recipes are off the charts. But I think the Kitchen Diaries is the one that I'm going to send to the cookbook.
Yes.
Hall of Fame, well, Cloud in the Sky, whatever you call it. Because I love Nigel Slater. I love his writing. I think he just evokes this incredible kind of visceral sense around food. And the Kitchen Diaries I love because every day of the year, there's somewhere you can go. There's some inspiration you can get. And even though Nigel does cook with a lot of meat and a lot of fish, it's more the like blanket of his words that I want than the actual recipe itself.
Definitely. So,
yeah, that's the one.
The seventh and final desert island dish. What is the last dish you would eat before being cast off to the desert island?
Well, that's really hard. And you know what? What I had in my head was that, because I was thinking about this a bit before, was that it was going to be a South Indian thali.
Ooh.
But then I'm just thinking, if I go to a desert island, will there be loads of coconuts? And will I be able to make that food on the desert island myself? I mean,
that is ambitious.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, if anyone can, I'm going to say you can.
Well, I don't know. I've never scaled a coconut tree. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's going to be my forte. But yeah, I think I love food that is colourful, that is all about sharing. And also because there's definitely like a greed element in there where you don't just get one meal on your plate, where you get like a load of different things, pickles, breads, everything that you can share. So I think it would be a South Indian thali. There's a lot of kind of, I've been to South India a lot of times. Me and my husband like share an enormous love of South India and its food, and that kind of curry leaf, mustard seed, coconut sort of triumvirate situation that is in all of the South Indian dishes. I literally like, that's pretty much my favorite flavor combination, I think. So yeah, I'd have a dal, I'd have a lovely like veg curry, I'd have one of their sambals, maybe I'd have a dosa on the side. You don't usually get those in thalis, but it's my last meal,
not?
So I don't care.
Yeah,
I'd have one of their amazing coconut pickles, I'd have a lemon pickle, I'd have some kind of mango chutney, we'd have rice, we'd have rotis, we'd have chapatis, we'd have paratha, you know, those twisty lovely breads that are delicious and buttery. I mean, we just have the works.
Anna, this sounds amazing. Are we gonna have pudding?
I think we would have pudding. I don't think I'd go down an Indian route for the pudding. The pudding I would have would be the pudding we had at our wedding.
Oh, what was that?
Which was totally amazing. It was brown sugar meringues and cherries. We got married in the middle of July, so cherries were kind of at their best, and they're my favorite thing. And then we had this kind of the amazing Stuart and Sarah, who cooked for us, they made this amazing I love custard, but I don't really love cream. So they made this kind of sort of almost chantilly, but kind of like with yogurt. So it was really fresh. They made their own kind of lemon curd. We had, I think it had some like elderflower in it. And then they piled up these amazing plates with these brown sugar meringues, this kind of like yogurty chantilly, the lemon curd. Then they kind of cook some cherries down with loads of different kind of like aromatics and stuff. And then there were fresh cherries all over it. And then because they were so amazing, I think they infused the cherries with myrtle, which is apparently a herb that represents everlasting love.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So I would have that.
Aww.
But we'd have to have Stuart and Sarah to come.
Well, obviously that goes without saying. Anna Jones, those were your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been so fun.
So there we are, another delicious day of desert island dishes. If you're listening and you haven't yet left a review, please do. It only takes a few seconds, and I know I'm always banging on about it, but it's genuinely very much appreciated and really makes a difference. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to go to the website www.desertislanddishes.co, where you'll find the full list of episodes, plus the recipes I've created inspired by each episode. You can come and say hi on Instagram and Twitter at Made by Margie. I would love to see you there. And other than that, thank you so much for listening. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.